session. The Honor Roll, Daniel R. Foley, Lawrence M. Reichert, and Lisa M. Vinoza presiding. Please be seated. Case number CAAB 12778, Noel Madamba Contracting LLC versus Ramon Romero and Cassie Romero. Samuel P. King Jr. for appellant, Michael C. Schwartz of K. Chetty LLP for appellee. Argument on merits.
Mr. King?
Thank you, Judge. First of all, thank you for having oral argument. As I think back, this might be the first time I've been in this room in 40 years. I remember we used to do a lot of arguments in the 70s, and then there was a big time there when there was nothing, and this is the first time back. Maybe before some people in this room were born, this last time I argued. Let me start by just, obviously, this is an appeal from an arbitration case. The broad issue on appeal is that we are claiming, as Noel Madamba Contracting LLC, that Judge Nishimura made an error in confirming the arbitration award in this case. Not only the arbitration award, but the subsequent award for our attorney's fees and then the general award that incorporate everything together, so it's all one appeal now. Under that broad heading, there are two main issues that we raise, and then a few sub-issues to those issues. The first main issue is 672E. We're claiming that 672E was basically a prerequisite to even filing the arbitration, and that wasn't done by the appellees in this case. Under that, the one subheading under that issue was the refusal to allow me to do a little bit of discovery when I raised that issue in the court before Judge Nishimura. Now, the argument that appellees made was that, well, you had a chance to take the deposition of Cassie Romero during the arbitration proceeding. Why did you do that? That's because the issue hadn't been raised. She made certain testimony at the arbitration hearing, and I was trying to preserve it in the record so we could make the argument to Judge Nishimura, but a motion to protect was filed, and Judge Nishimura granted that. So I was denied my chance to make a further record on that issue. However, if you look in Mr. Yim's arbitration decision, when he rejected my 672 argument, one of the things he ruled, he wrote two motions, the first one right at the beginning of the arbitration, then one afterwards, after the arbitration hearing was closed in November of 2011, I guess it was, or maybe it was 10, long ago. I made an initial motion on 672, then I made a second one. He made an initial decision, then he filed an amended decision, and the only difference between the two was that he added in there, I think it was paragraph 18 of his little decision, that it was irrelevant that the complainant, the Romeros, knew anything about 672E. He totally rejected that argument. But when I attempted to raise
it. How is it relevant? How is the intent of the Romeros relevant?
Well, what I was trying to show was that when that letter was written in September 7th, 2010, when that letter was written to Noel Madamba Contracting LLC, what we were arguing was there was no way that any reasonable contractor could take that to be a 672E letter. At that point he had not been kicked off the job. It was ongoing construction. It was a letter written complaining about certain things. You know, you got to fix this, you got to do that, you got to clean up this mess, you got to take the paint off the door. There's no way that any reasonable contractor could have construed that to be 672E. 672E comes in at the end when everything has fallen apart and there's no hope. And that did occur a couple months later when Mr. Romero came to my client and just said, I think it was late October, like October 31st, and he just said, you're off the job, get out of here. That's when 672E cuts in.
But isn't notice the face of the letter and not the intent of the person sending it?
I would say that, yes, that's true, Judge. Yes, it's true. The letter that was sent made no mention of 672E, so I think it's relevant to show, it's certainly relevant to show that the person that wrote it had no concept of 672E, because 672E requires certain things to be in there, you know, listing of all the construction defects. It's supposed to be the last step before filing suit. So I think it is relevant to know whether the person that wrote it had any intent whatsoever to follow 672E, because there certainly wasn't anything in that letter which would have put a reasonable contractor on notice that 672E was even contemplated in that letter. So I think you're right, I agree with you, and that's that case that I cited, from this jurisdiction, but they did talk about the face of the letter, and had, there was nothing in the face of the letter in that case that it would indicate to the contractor in that case that it had any intention of invoking the particular statute in another jurisdiction. But same thing, same argument. So I think it's relevant, but you're right. In the end, the issue is what's on the face of the document.
And whether or not there was adequate notice, isn't that for the arbitrator to decide?
Well, I think it is initially, Judge. I think it is. And I think, you know, there is an overlapping. The second issue here is failure to disclose, and that's the issue that really gets my gut in this case. And I think, you know, Judge Nishimura went off on a tangent trying to find where Judge Yim might have been. Mr. Yim might have been showing his feelings against us. And that was one of the places where I think he did it. Although Judge Nishimura actually disposed of 672E before we even got to the final argument on exactly the same argument you made. Well, that's for the arbitrator. I'm not going to think about that. That's why we raised the issue that yes, it's true that normally speaking, the arbitrator gets to decide a legal issue, but if there's a strong public policy associated with that legal issue, then the court can step in and say, wait a minute, you know, yeah, I see what you did, arbitrator, and normally speaking, we're not going to step in on a legal error, but this one is like, forget it. This is so far beyond the pale that we have to step in and support the strong legal basis, the strong public policy for having a 672E letter. And I cite in my brief the committee reports from the legislature, and one of the things they talked about was the crisis. They used the word crisis in construction litigation, so they wanted to have, and the crisis, of course, was tying up the courts, or arbitration proceedings. So what they wanted was a final, definitive attempt and a clear letter from one party to the homeowner, because it's residential homeowners, to send a clear notice to the contractor. Look, here's the final stuff. Here's reports of our experts. You get one more shot at it.
Go ahead.
That wasn't done in this case.
When you're talking public policy, and that public policy should be a basis for us to go back and look at the arbitrator's decision on an issue of law.
Right.
Are you aware of any case in Hawaii or otherwise where, in a similar circumstance, on public policy basis, an arbitrator's decision was vacated?
Yes.
Because there's a very high standard for the public policy exception.
Yes, Judge, that's a good question. And I did, Judge Acoba actually addressed that issue, and I have it in my brief. Let's see the name of the case.
Inman Boatman?
Yeah, it's... it's on page 29 of my brief, and it's the Gipaya case. Even if the court agrees with Judge Nishimura that the court will normally not step in, there's a public policy exception, Gipaya and Kona Village, actually, for the public policy, and then citing to Kona Village, for the public policy exception to apply, you have to show the award would violate some explicit public policy, which I think it does because 672E, I think, is a strong public policy statute, which the legislature said was intended to prevent a crisis. And you have to show the violation of the public policy is clearly shown. And our argument, as Judge Foley mentioned, has to be on the basis of the face of the letter that was sent. Because the letter that was sent is supposed to be the 672E notice. And, you know, you've seen our argument about that. And the letter was sent during construction, not at the end of construction. Didn't mention 672E, didn't put anybody on notice that, okay, now we're into the 672E process. And in fact, my client kept going on with construction after that letter was sent. So it's clearly not the last statement to be made.
How would you draw the line, though, if you're arguing that public policy is the basis for stepping in to vacate an arbitrator's ruling on the law? I mean, the challenge, of course, is how you draw that line.
Right. I agree. And I think that's why I cited the legislative intent, because obviously every law that gets, you know, if the arbitrator makes some ruling on you know, parole evidence rule or something, you're not going to step in on that. So, yeah, you do have to look at what law are we talking about and how strong is the public policy. That's why I cited to the legislative reports. And, you know, when the legislature says this law is intended to prevent a crisis, then I think, you know, you're right. I think you need to find something somewhere that says, hey, this is not just any old error of law. This is a crisis kind of law. And that's exactly what we have here. And again, I think our argument is, if you look at that letter, it wasn't intended to be that, it wasn't that. And in fact, my client continued to do construction afterwards, and there was no breakup between the two parties, except at the very end, in late October, when my client got kicked off the job by Mr. Romero, and then the case firm, about a week or 10 days later, wrote a second letter. And again, it didn't make any reference to 672. It just said, you're kicked out, come get your stuff and get off the property.
Along those lines, would it be your position then, in this type of case, 672E-3, a notice case,
yes,
in this type of arbitration, that a court could always second-guess an arbitrator on the letter, or is it just the letter in this case?
I would say that it's a strong enough public policy so that the court can at least be asked to take a look at it. If the court finds that there's a reasonable basis for the arbitrator to have made his decision, then of course you're going to say, well, yeah, I see what you're saying, Mr. King, and you know, it's a strong enough public policy issue for us to take a look, and you know, we just don't find it. So I think we have to make a strong showing that there's a violation of the statute.
Legislature could have written that into the statutes, couldn't it, if it wanted to, in terms of this?
It could have, Judge, it could have. Yet at the same time, the Kona Village case doesn't require that. That's not one of the two requirements. All it requires is that there be some explicit public policy, strongly, and in fact, in Kona Village, I think it had to do with attorney's fees. You know, it wasn't one of those things you think was particularly strong, but they went into it anyway. And again, yes, they could have, absolutely. And in fact, in arbitration cases, you know, the legislature is strictly limited, actually, the amount and the way you can appeal. They could have, they didn't, but that doesn't mean that you can't find a strong public policy.
But there's also a strong public policy for arbitration, right?
That's true. That's true, and you have to weigh the two. And so I think at least if you find that there's a strong public policy in 672E, you can take a look. And I think there is a strong public policy. Then I think, I admit that we have the burden to show, okay, you know, we'll take a look, you know, how bad was this? And if you look at this letter and you say, oh my God, there's just no way a reasonable arbitrator could have ruled this way, and that was my feeling. And then, you know, come February, you know, a month after he issues his preliminary decision, then we find out all of this background information, and well, I wasn't surprised. Judge Nishimura didn't find herself surprised, but I wasn't surprised. And so these two issues overlap. The issue, and the second issue being the failure of Judge Yim to disclose. And I think, you know, I was lying again this morning thinking, if one of the three judges asked me, Mr. King, which do you think is the most important issue in this case, and we just want to hear you for 1 minute, it's the failure to disclose issue. That, I think, is the most important issue to us. And in connection with the way Judge Nishimura analyzed it, because if you look at the record, we said that there was a failure to disclose, and there was a failure to disclose under Rule 9, DPR Rule 9, which the parties are bound to follow. In fact, Rule 9 is even cited. It wasn't the deciding issue in the case, but it was mentioned. It's in my footnote. On page 5 and 6 of my brief, And DP Article 9 is actually mentioned in the K case as another requirement that the parties follow. And HRS 658A, 4A, and B3 allow the parties to bind themselves to agreements and arbitration beyond what's in the statute, as long as they don't limit the requirements in the statute. And in fact, 658A(b)(3) says that you can have other requirements. What you can't do is limit the disclosure requirement of the arbitrator. You can expand on it. So then the question is, DPR Rule 9 talks about possible future relationship. Yes, it's true that language is not in 658A12. 658A12 talks, here it is right here, says, before accepting an appointment, an individual who's requested to serve as arbitrator shall disclose any known facts that a reasonable person would consider likely to affect impartiality of the arbitrator, including, now it doesn't say including but not limited to, but it's just including certain things. It doesn't limit itself to that. The first one is financial or personal interest. The second is existing or past relationship. Now, DPR has their Rule 9 says existing or past relationship or possible future relationship. Now, when you look at just the words existing or past relationship, that doesn't necessarily mean it doesn't include future possible relationship, because if there's going to be a future possible relationship, there must be something existing now in the present which is going to result in that future possible relationship. For example, I got an attorney friend who I've been working with in this case, and the example he gave to me, which I think is a great one, is certainly you'd want to know if the arbitrator was married to one of the partners in the firm representing the other side. That's for sure. Okay, what if he's only engaged? So the future possible relationship, he's going to get married, so now he's engaged. And if you look at the facts in this case, back in May of 2010, when we were just picking an arbitrator, Mr. Yim had already talked to his pension company, and he had already been told that it was either going to be Cage or Carl Smith doing his pension plan. And then we picked him on June 1, and he made disclosures. He said, well, you know, I do this, I do that. He didn't say anything about Cage potentially representing him in his pension business. Then by the end of June, only 1 month into the arbitration, already his pension company had sent a request to Cage to do a conflict check. Cage had already said he's cleared, so he was clear. And then he has a continuing duty to disclose, and he has a continuing duty to at least check and see, you know, is this going to come up? April 15th of the next year was when he had to start disclosing all his pension stuff, because it's for IRS purposes. This arbitration was set for November. It was clear that there was a sure possibility that something was going to come up, and he already had the potential existing. Now, if we had known about that back in May, I've been told that the Cage or Carl Smith, the 50-50 chance that Cage or Carl Smith is going to be my pension company, we would have said, well, thank you, Judge. In fact, in this case, Cully Watson is actually, if you look in the records in my big black binders here, by the way, DPR fought me tooth and nail on every single document. I just asked in the middle of the case with Judge Nishimura, I just asked for the file documents, and they fought me on that. I had to make a motion to Judge Nishimura, and she said, well, you've made a prima facie showing of, you know, it took me that, anyway. Cully Watson was asked to be the first arbitrator, and then we wrote an email, and it's in the record, saying, well, I hear that Cully Watson and Mr. Yim work out at Clark Hatch a lot, and they're good buddies, so, you know, we're not going to pick him. So we were very attentive to anything that's going to work. So if we were told, 50-50 chance that Judge Yim or Mr. Yim is going to get Cage as one of its pension lawyers, I'd say, well, thank you very much, but there's plenty of other arbitrators in town. So Yim didn't disclose that. He didn't check within a month to see that he'd already been approved for Cage, not Carl Smith. When they sent the December 30 letter at the end of the year saying, okay, we're gonna appoint one of two firms in Hawaii, and he knew exactly which two firms it were, was, then on January 20th now, he meets with his pension, the guy who runs the pension plan, Mr. Kiwata, And he is told that it's probably going to be Cades. On January 20th now, on the 26th, that's when he issues his partial final. And that means the state of mind that he had when he issued his partial final was that Cades was going to be his attorney. And they try to minimize that and say, oh, it's no big deal, you know, so what if he's going to, if we're going to be his pension attorney? It is a big deal. Any rational, reasonable arbitrator would want to know that. And then when Judge Yim, when Mr. Yim finally started disclosing when he had these things, he said, oh, no, that didn't happen until January 30th. And I didn't find out that that wasn't true until I started taking depositions and found, oh, no, it was January 20th. So there was all kinds of deceptive disclosures going on here. It was incredible.
Mr. King, in order to have an arbitration decision vacated under the statute, 658A23,
right.
There are very specific bases for vacating
right.
an arbitration decision. And what you're basically talking about, I think, is evident partiality.
Exactly.
Okay, so what is your test for evident partiality?
Okay.
And what is your legal authority for that?
Okay, that is the big issue in this case. Judge Nishimura agreed with me that the Judge Yim, Mr. Yim, failed to disclose. She actually made that holding, and it's not on cross appeal here. And there's nothing bizarre about her holding, so I think that's binding on this court. If she finds that there was a failure to disclose, then if you look at 658A12, it says in subparagraph E, an arbitrator appointed a neutral who does not disclose a known existing or substantial relationship with a party is presumed to act with evident partiality under 258A23A2, and in particular, A2A, little a to big A, which is evident partiality. So in this case, it's a matter of record that Judge Nishimura ruled that he failed to disclose. And they haven't cross-appealed that issue. That's binding. That's binding in this appeal unless this court wants to step in and say for some reason that's such... I mean, they're not even arguing that that's such far error made by Judge Nishimura that the court can't bind it. It's perfectly valid.
Does it matter if it's an existing relationship as opposed to your example
possible
future?
No, I don't think so, because... The way this statute is written, 658A, it's written in terms of it's like you said, 658A12(2), it says existing or past relationship. First of all, what I'm arguing is talking about possible future doesn't mean every time there's a possible future, there has to be an existing. Otherwise, there wouldn't be a possible future. So possible future is just kind of expanding, making sure that arbitrators realize that, look, you can't play this game where, oh, well, it doesn't quite exist yet, which is exactly the game Judge Yim played with us, Mr. Yim. You got to let people know what's coming. You know, if it's a possible future, you got to let them know. So that language isn't in here, but it's based on an existing situation. And because there's a failure to disclose found by the judge, that means there's presumed to be evident partiality. Where she went wrong, then she said, oh, well, now I'm going to go hunting. In my view, once you find evident partiality, that's it. Award is vacated unless we, like in Daiichi, if you waive your chance to raise that issue, okay, it's waived.
Well, to be clear, she didn't find evident partiality. What she found was a failure to disclose
right.
to the extent that she addressed that.
That's
but,
right.
But she
but,
did not equate that to evident partiality.
But okay, but what I'm saying, I see my time's up. What I'm saying is she should have, and real quickly, where she went wrong is then she went off looking for places where she could see whether or not he was arbitrary or whether he showed partiality. If that were the test, we would never, that's a meaningless test, because you're never, if an arbitrator is going to be partial, they're going to be more than clever enough to hide their partiality. Oh, it's just a decision. It's just like Judge Foley said, it's just a decision, just a factual decision. You'll never find anything. It's not based on what he did. It's based on the state of mind of the person who should have had the disclosure. Are reasonable, not just, you know, subjective, object, a reasonable person. And a reasonable person in this case would have wanted to know.
Thank you, Mr. King. Mr. Short.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. King is correct. I've actually never been in this courtroom before, other for the record, we had objected to the extraneous attachments to the brief. We believe that they went over the page limit. That's not what our main argument is in this case, however, just for the record, that is our position. Our view is that the main issue in this case is whether the disclosure of the possible future relationship by arbitrator Yim between him and one of the counsel for one of the parties in this arbitration constitutes evident partiality such that the award needs to be vacated. And we think that's really the main issue here. We can talk about the 672E issue, but we view that as an issue that's within the purview of the arbitrator. That is what Judge Nishimura ruled, and we don't view that as a basis to vacate or even make an inquiry into. So the record is quite clear. On February 22nd, 2012, Judge Yim disclosed that Pension Services Corporation had decided to hire Cade Shuddy to do work on his personal retirement account. On February 24th, Madamba objected to that relationship and indicated that they were not happy. On February 29th, Judge Yim responded to some questions that Madamba included in his February 24th objection, and also stated that in light of Madamba's objections, he had instructed Pension Services Corporation not to retain Kate Shuddy and to instead retain Carlson Ball. And I should interject here for a moment. Your Honors, you probably noticed I have a bit of a dry cough, so I have a cough drop here. I'm going to try not to resort to it, but I mean no disrespect if I have to. So the foregoing was a disclosure, and the future possible relationship was then never formed as a result of Madamba's objection to the arbitrator's disclosure. So the court ruled, as the appellant concedes at page 24 of his brief, that there was no formulated relationship. I think we're all on the same page that this was a potential or possibility of a future relationship. And the distinction is interesting because it moves, it puts more stress on DPR Rule 9 than on HRS 658A12. So there are two sources relevant to the inquiry of whether vacator should result. The first are sections 12 and 23 of HRS 658A. Further, DPR Rule 9 must be taken into account. And as I've said, the central issue is whether that disclosure and then decision not to consummate the future relationship demonstrated evident partiality in that vacator must follow. So we've been through the standard. It's a de novo review. However, the court limits its review and keeps in mind that the circuit court's ability to review the arbitrator's decision is very limited. And so, interestingly, the appellant argues on page 31 of his opening brief that a finding of a breach of duty to disclose is a finding of partiality. And we think respectfully that this is not correct. It's contradicted by the plain language of 658A12, which states that in the event of a non-disclosure, the court under section 658A23A2 may vacate the award. So the word is may and not shall. And subsequent to the briefing in this case, the Nordic decision was issued by this court, and two of the members on this panel were on the Nordic court, so I'm not even going to try and explain what the Nordic decision was. I assume that you are all very familiar with it. However, I would call the court's attention to footnote 4 in the Nordic case, which states that when the non-disclosure concerns a relationship with a party, there is a presumption of evident partiality. However, when the non-disclosure concerns a relationship with a party's counsel, there is no presumption of evident partiality. Therefore, under both 658A12 and the Nordic decision, it's Madama's burden to demonstrate evident partiality. So then, when faced with that question in front of Judge Nishimura, Madamba offered two things as evidence of evident partiality. The first was the 672E argument, which we have just heard. And the second was the denial of all of appellant's post-arbitration motions and the signing of appellee's proposed findings of fact and conclusions of law almost verbatim. So those were the only two arguments that were made to Judge Nishimura with respect to attempting to demonstrate evident partiality. So Judge Nishimura examined that. She stated that she had reviewed both of those arguments and that she did not believe that she did not agree with Madamba that those two factors constituted evident partiality. And even if they had, she observed the word is may and not shall, and therefore she confirmed the word. So,
Mr. Schwartz, what about Mr. King's argument that we're not really talking about a future possible relationship, that it actually was an existing relationship that under 658A12 was required to be disclosed, and if in fact it was an existing relationship, then vis-a-vis, I think it's 658A12E, is presumed to be an act of evident partiality, the failure to disclose that. How do you address that?
Yes, I think that two things. Number one, 658A12E talks about a relationship with a party, not with a party's counsel. And Nordic, this is not just an artificial distinction. Nordic actually distinguishes between the two types of relationships. The idea being that in a small community like Hawaii, there are only so many law firms, there are only so many arbitrators, there are only so many judges, and there are going to be repeat relationships, formally, informally, socially. People are going to run into each other at restaurants, clubs, and that sort of thing. So I think the distinction is crucial. Not only that, but with respect to I believe that Nordic clarified 658E12E, the distinction between the party and counsel in relation and the possible future relationship. And so I think that we have to revert back to 658A12D, which says may. So then Judge Nishimura would still have to make that inquiry as to whether there was evident partiality. And the statute clearly empowers her with deciding whether that warrants vacator or not. So, as I said, in a small community like Hawaii, you're going to have situations like this. There will be situations where a possible future relationship occurs after an arbitration has started. It happens all the time, probably less so in the context of pension services. I would concede that this is a fairly unique case factually, but one can envision quite simply where an arbitrator is contacted by somebody at the same law firm as a possible neutral in a future future matter going forward. So the question becomes, when something like that happens, what is the arbitrator to do? And I think the answer is clearly that the arbitrator needs to disclose that communication occurred and give parties a chance to object. If you look at the K case, if you look at all the cases the K cites to, the thing that the court, both the Hawaii Supreme Court, the ICA, and even the U.S. Supreme Court goes back to is disclosure as a remedy for this sort of situation. So in this case, there was a disclosure. And once that disclosure is made and a party objects, what this court has to decide is what happens next. Does the fact that there has been a possible future relationship that arises after the arbitration starts mean that the objecting party has an absolute veto power? Can they therefore say, hey, if this thing is not going our way, we get vacator automatically just because there was a possible future relationship? And I think clearly the answer is no, and what should happen is what happened in this case. The arbitrator decided not to hire Cades, not to go forward with a possible future relationship, and there's got to be something some alternative besides just voiding the entire process up to that point.
So what is your test for evident partiality if by the statute, 658A12, it's not clearly indicated that there is evident partiality in a case? So we're now in the factual realm of was there evident partiality. What is the test?
Well, I think that the test is quite clearly set out in the cases, Your Honor. It has to be a relationship that's close enough. They speak in terms of parties. The relationship has to be close enough that a reasonable person would believe that there is a reasonable possibility for partiality. You don't have to demonstrate actual bias. I think that that's pretty clear in the cases, Your Honor.
Is there, should there be an ability to have discovery on that issue?
I think it's going to depend on the circumstances, Your Honor. In this case, I think that Judge Nishimura allowed discovery. The DPR records were ordered produced. There was a deposition of Ellen Kawashima of the Kate Shetty Law Firm, which, by the way, was not put in the record by the appellants because they didn't get anything out of that deposition. I mean, if they had, wouldn't that have been Exhibit A?
She's the attorney that would have worked on the trust matters.
At Kate Shetty, yes. Correct, Your Honor, the pension matters.
Pension.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor, at Kate Shetty. And, you know, that deposition transcript also revealed that she had informed Pension Services Company that we couldn't take the case because we occasionally use Judge Yim as a mediator or an arbitrator. So, you know, the fact that in this case, it was all above board, Your Honor. It was disclosed, and there was an objection, as was Madonna's right. The whole purpose of disclosure is to give the party right to object, and the question is where do you go once an objection is registered?
So just procedurally, the arbitration award gets issued. You file a motion, or your firm files a motion to confirm. Mr. King's office files a motion to vacate. And subsequently, just in a nutshell, what were the procedural steps that then occurred in the circuit court? You folks had discovery at that point.
Yes, Your Honor, just for the record, I wasn't involved in the case at that time, so I'm going off of the written record, but my understanding is, and I'm sure Mr. King will correct me if I get this wrong, my understanding is what happened is the partial award came down. After that, the possible future relationship was disclosed, and then Mr. King, on behalf of Madonna, objected, said, hey, you know, we're going to file something in front of Judge Nishimura asking for a new arbitrator. We ask that you stay everything. DPR's response was, look, unless there's a stay from the circuit court, we're going to proceed. And so Mr. King, on behalf of Mr. Madonna, filed an ex parte motion to shorten time for the various relief that he was requesting from the circuit court, at which point the circuit court actually moved up the hearing. Mr. King was granted the ability to depose not only Ellen Kawashima of our firm, but also Mr. Kiwata and Ms. Kiwata. It's a father-daughter, not husband-wife, at Pension Services Corporation. That's when Mr. King discovered that one of the meetings in question happened on January 20th, not January 30th. He then asked to take depositions of people at DPR. For some inexplicable reason, after saying that he wanted to depose DPR, he then delayed for, I believe, 6 to 8 weeks until the actual hearing on the motion to vacate came up, at which point he asked for more time to go ahead and depose DPR again. And Judge Nishimura basically said, no, you know, I'm going to go ahead and rule. You've already had your discovery. So that's a very long answer to Your Honor's question, but the answer is that in this case, discovery was allowed. Extensive discovery was allowed. What was not allowed, Your Honor, was discovery on the 672E issue. The judge ruled that was something that was within the purview of the arbitrator. However, with respect to the disclosure, with respect to evident partiality, there was ample discovery allowed to be conducted here. And if you look, Your Honor, the partial final award came down in January, and in fact, the hearing on the motion to vacate was not until August 1st, 2012. That delay was solely so that Madamba could conduct discovery on his various objections and bases to argue evident partiality.
The disclosure issue.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. So,
Mr. Yim's potential relationship with Cades was at the time of the arbitration, but only after the arbitration was concluded did that situation change. The potential relationship Judge Yim or Mr. Yim had with Cage Law Firm,
yes,
supposedly representing him, was at the time of the arbitration.
I think we have a disagreement, Your Honor, between the Madonna and our side. And let me explain why. The record states that Judge Yim was informed that Pension Services Corporation was considering two possible law firms, but the way that it was described is that Mr. Kiwata says that he told Judge Yim that he was considering an attorney named Mr. Fonseca. What's missing is the link between showing that Judge Yim knew or should have known that Roger Fonseca was at Cades. I think if you talked to me on the street, I wouldn't know where.
I would have known.
I may not have. Perhaps it's because I haven't been practicing here nearly as long.
Mr. Yim would have known.
Okay. If that's the court's determination, I'm not.
I mean, it's not part of the record, but it's.
I understand.
Mr. Fonseca is a very well-known attorney.
I understand, Your Honor. And so basically, the way the record plays out, and taking that into account, is that Judge Yim was informed. Arbitrator Yim was informed on January 20th. Prior to that, it was more general about, you know, there would be one of two firms and the like. Judge Yim's disclosure states that the first time he actively knew that Cades was going to be involved was a few days prior to his initial disclosure. That would be the February 20th, 2014 initial email from DPR saying Judge Yim has found out that Pension Services Corporation has hired Cades Shuddy. So I think there's a bit of a disagreement as to when Judge Yim, or Arbitrator Yim actually.
Wouldn't discovery have helped clear that up?
I believe so, Your Honor, and discovery did in fact help clear that up, and Mr. Kiwata's deposition demonstrated that it was on January 20th, 2014. So that was explored. What was not permitted was the depositions of DPR. Keith Hunter, Kelly Bryant, and I believe there's one other individual that they wanted to depose at DPR. Query whether DPR would have better knowledge of when the relationship, the potential future relationship came into being than Mr. Kiwata, who did the hiring, or his daughter, who was essentially the administrator and the attorney that was going to be on the other side of the possible future relationship. So I guess then the question would become how much discovery is enough, rather than whether discovery should be permitted or not. So in this case, there was ample discovery permitted, Your Honor. And as I say, the time from when the first, from when the partial final award came out, when the motion to vacate actually came up was 8 months. So there was ample discovery in there. And with respect to the other three depositions, recall that the main reason they didn't go forward was because there was a tardy deposition notice. They weren't actually noticed until well past the window that was permitted for discovery. So, and that, you know, that's all part of the record. So, again, Your Honors, I think what this boils down to is the court needs to decide whether what happened here is correct or proper, or whether the rejection of a prospective future relationship between an arbitrator and a law firm of one of the parties after the disclosure constitutes evident partiality, and therefore the vacator needs to occur. And you know, the Romeros respectfully submit that there is absolutely no proof of any partiality as found by Judge Nishimura in this matter. And so, responding for a moment to the public policy argument that was made by the other side, you know, the legislative history that was put into the record was all about avoiding litigation, and the crisis referred to cases before the court and insurance problems and that sort of thing. So I find it very ironic that they're now trying to essentially litigate to get out of arbitration. They asked for a jury trial on their 658A23 motion. That is an issue on appeal here, whether they're entitled to a jury trial in 658A23. We went to arbitration primarily because it's cheaper and faster, and this is not a concern that's unique to the Romeros. If you look at the Daiichi case, they quote a whole line of cases in Hawaii that state that it must be deemed that the primary purpose of arbitration is to avoid litigation.
Mr. Schwartz, at some point in the record, I thought I saw that there actually was a trial scheduled. Did I read the record correct? Are you aware of whether a trial was actually scheduled at some point?
You know, Your Honor, I'm not aware of that. I'm not sure. Perhaps Mr. King.
Obviously, a trial didn't occur. I was just curious how a trial would even get scheduled where you're dealing with a motion to confirm or vacate an arbitration.
Honestly, Your Honor, I have no idea how that would have occurred. Just by looking at the index number, this was initiated as a special proceeding.
Right.
And therefore, I would be surprised if a trial were scheduled.
Maybe it was a reference to a trial being continued or something like that in the Bruce. But, you're not aware of a trial.
I am not aware. That's not to say it didn't happen, because, as I say, I was not involved in this case at that point. The appellees would submit that Judge Nishimura reached the correct result under the correct standard, even without having the benefit of the NORA decision, which was decided subsequent to her decision.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kane, rebuttal?
Sorry, I'm going to
clean up all my stuff here. Judge Munoz, I think if I had to think about the most unfair thing that happened, I mean, talk about the law, talk about the facts, the most unfair thing that happened in this case was our denial of a right to a hearing, and at that hearing, a right to a jury trial. Mr. Schwartz got the procedure. You asked about the procedure aspects. He got it all right except for the very end. Mr. Yim came down with an award. I made a motion to try and stop him from issuing his final award because of the so-called disclosures that were starting to be made. He issued, and I did get the judge finally to move up a hearing on that. And so Mr. Yim issued his final award one day before that hearing was set, so I mooted out my chance to stop him.
That's in April of 2012.
That's right. I think it was in April, yeah.
And then the hearing was held the day after.
I stood up in court and said, well, he beat me to the punch, Judge. Sorry, now we're into, vacating the award. But where Mr. Schwartz gets it 100% wrong is, I did take the deposition, and I didn't have to ask. I just started taking depositions. Nobody objected. So I took the deposition, and they wouldn't have been able to stop me because it was obviously relevant. I took the deposition of Mr. Kiwata. I took the deposition of his daughter. I took the deposition of another employee at his firm, and I took the deposition of Ellen Kawashima. The reason her deposition was not in the record was I never got a chance to finish that, although Mr. Schwartz made some reference to it, even though it's not in the record. And there is reference to it. And when I argued in front of the judge, I made some reference to some of the things that Ellen Kawashima said. Basically, she just said everything she needs to protect the case from getting sued for malpractice is basically what it came down. But the reason I stopped her depo is because I wanted to then take it, because she contradicted a lot of the things that Mr. Yim had said in his so-called disclosures. So I wanted to take the deposition. I think I got to make a prima facie showing. That's what the statute says. I've got to make a prima facie showing in order to be able to take the deposition of Mr. Yim and DPR people. Yes, Yim has protection. He's like a judge, but I can still take his deposition if I make a prima facie showing. And if you look at Exhibit G of my attached to my brief, that's the
email
declaration that I submitted showing all the disputed issues of fact that I wanted to take Yim's deposition, see if he knew who Roger Fonseca was back in May, if Roger Fonseca was associated with the Cades firm. Why didn't he check the month later to see if he was going to get picked? Why didn't he disclose the December 30 letter? How come he got – see, the disclosures were not being made by him. They were being made by Kelly Bryant. So I wanted to take the deposition of Kelly Bryant, see if she'd made a mistake on that January 30th thing, and did Judge Yim tell her January 30th, or was she making a mistake, and he really said January 20th, because it makes a big difference. On January 20th, he hadn't issued his final arbitration award, partial final. It was until the 26th. So the most unfair thing that happened to us in this case, it's like a motion for summary judgment, the August 1 hearing. It's like a motion for summary judgment. It's a reasonable man standard where when we're the reasonable man, should the disclosure have been made to us Is it the kind of disclosure a reasonable man would want to see? And were there no disputed issues of fact as of August 1? So I noted the deposition of all those people. And the reason it didn't get taken for 6 to 8 weeks is because DPR filed a motion to stop me. And Judge Nishimura set that motion for the same day as the August 1st hearing. So I never got a chance to do my discovery. And that, if anything else, this thing ought to be remanded so that I can do legitimate discovery. And if you look at my Exhibit G, you'll see all the disputed issues of fact that never got resolved.
Mr. King, Mr. Schwartz, thank you very much. We'll take the matter under advisement.